Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, a founder that has, done it a few times, obviously sometimes with success, other times, great lessons learned. And now he's in a rocket ship, that he's building. So we're going to be talking about the incredible, strategy that he used when he came to fundraising and his view of the world when he was really looking, at the problem that he was going to be addressing later on. We're going to be talking about building the team as well. And also about the balance, of really working and live and all of that stuff that typically people, especially founders, don't talk much because it tends to be all about work, but it's all about energy, because you're not energized and there's no health, there's nothing. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Brian Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alejandro.
So originally born in California, but grew up in a very sexy place, the Hamptons. So tell us about life. How was life growing up?
It was a strange contrast. So of course, folks that visit the Hamptons think it's always like that year round. But when you live there, it's actually not as glamorous. I grew up, middle class, but really it was a lot of work. In the winter, it's dead, and maybe some of that's changing now, but when I grew up, I went to a public school and there were 86 kids in my graduating class. And, I to put some money in my pocket, I worked at the local hardware store. And that was sort of how I was raised. It was a very interesting contrast between what happened during the winter where I lived versus what happened during the summer. Very different sort of lifestyles, and the ebb and flow of that really set, I think, a grounding for my future.
So then in your case, how was it like, like growing up with all of that incredible wealth around you and seeing that too? I'm sure that fueled the, ambition, that you had as well.
I think that's totally true. I learned very quickly that, oh, right, you don't have to physically work at the hardware store all day. Not that that's a bad thing, but for me, I was able to realize early on, oh, there's a way for me to use my brain and my brain power to succeed and achieve these goals that I had in life early on. So yeah, that contrast was a good teacher. The other thing that happened is I had an incredible math teacher. And in the sixth grade, she actually had a special class where you can build a website and track stocks in Excel. That was the class. And so that in combination with, what I really learned in the summer months versus the winter months, really, I think was grounding and fuel for a lot of my ambition early on.
So then in your case, you end up at Babson, one of the most known universities for entrepreneurship. So at what point do you make that choice? Hey, I really want to study this thing because I may be able to, or I might do something, of my own. So what was that the thought process like?
Well, first of all, Babson was the only school I applied to. I was either going to Babson or I wasn't going to go to college. I didn't necessarily shop around or anything. I just realized that at the first year of Babson, there's this special class where you can actually start a business your first year with 30 of your classmates. That's kind of what sold me. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to build something. I was passionate about, several ideas at the time. Several of them were computer and internet related. And that really gave me a grounding, really cemented this idea that it's going to be hard work. It might be the most challenging thing you do, but if you want to start a company and you're smart about the opportunity you pick and you're smart about the way that you build it, that this is actually something that you can do. And that was one of the most important lessons that I learned at Babson. It's also this energy where everyone wanted to do this. You didn't go to Babson unless you wanted to eventually, in one form or another, start your own business.
So then in this case, for you, you started also to learn how to program, You know, I think that was kind of like your location there, where you were in the dorm. So why programming? You know, what did you see in programming that perhaps, you know, you thought it could be useful to you?
In middle school, I had a group of friends and we built computers. In fact, the first business I ever did as a child, we would build and sell computers, you know, to all of our parents, right? And so I was always interested in computers. I always like needed to understand how they worked. And when I got to Babson, I kind of came across this again because my sophomore year, I ended up living in a dorm that was closer to our sister school called Olin Engineering. And it turns out that our cafeteria card could swipe into Olin the same way it could swipe into our own cafeteria at Babson. The funny thing about my sophomore dorm is that it was actually like pretty far away from the lunch cafeteria. And it's Boston. It's the middle of the winter. Kind of the last thing you want to do is take a trek all the way across campus to go to the cafeteria. So it turned out walking over to Olin, I could swipe in. It was a shorter walk. And the folks that went to Olin Engineering were all extremely talented. They're sort of small classes, but really, really smart, talented individuals that attend that college. And after hanging out with them a little bit and having some lunches with them, they sort of started to encourage me to take, you know, some classes and some credits over at Olin Engineering. And that really was the start of what inspired me to start to write code and learn engineering. So I do have some credits there, but for the most part, the majority of my engineering skills were self-taught as a, you know, sort of after school work once I took those classes.
So for you, obviously, you know, it was just a matter of time. So tell us about how embarking into the first rodeo, what did that look like? Because obviously it didn't end the way that you had hoped, but as they say, you either succeed or you learn.
Yeah, I actually had an idea at the time the world, and I think still is, like a lot of the internet's really powered by WordPress. And, you know, I was really fascinated by WordPress. At the time I was writing a lot of PHP, which is what WordPress is built on. But I thought there was potentially a better way. For the most part, I was frustrated with the way the data got delivered in WordPress. It kind of felt all like within one box. And something about that didn't feel right, especially around, you know, 2011, 2012, when the advent of, you know, more powerful iPhones were coming to market. This is a time when Bourbon just turned into Instagram and these things were happening. I thought, wow, if apps are going to be the new future of the world, how are we going to get content into these apps? And what's the web going to look like on mobile devices over the next 10 years? So I started this company. It was called PipeStack, and it was a content management system. And the whole point of it is that it worked with an API on the front end. And that's how you would use your engineering skills to use that API to kind of build into, say, your app or, you know, your mobile web experience. So I think today I didn't have the terminology back then, but today we would look back and we would say that was probably one of the first headless CMSs that at least was conceived of.
Now, for you in this case, the outcome, you know, left you in not a very good financial situation.
Yeah, I couldn't raise money. No one really understood the value of why you wouldn't have a front end, which is fair. And so I ended up using a credit card to fund a lot of my life. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden I'm in about $120,000 of debt. So I actually had to close the company down and I had to figure out how to pay off that debt and cover the cost of living. At the time I was in San Francisco, which, you know, was not cheap. So I ended up doing some consulting work. I was basically working all day and all night for about 6-7 months, to pay down that debt. And I was luckily able to get several jobs because, you know, San Francisco at that time was just booming in terms of tech startups and in terms of people wanting to get and build businesses online. So I was able to work really hard to dig myself out of that hole. And, you know, proud to say I still don't have debts to this day. Careful with credit cards now. But that was something that I learned. Wow, this skill that I picked up of engineering, you know, if all goes to hell and everything goes wrong, I can really depend on it to make sure that I'm okay.
So what was that segue, you know, that got you into Nacelle? Because, I mean, the next rodeo was really, you know, putting together an agency for software development, you know, type of work. So how did it, you know, transition into you getting started with Nacelle?
Yeah. So I realized, oh, wow, this idea of consulting is a good way to make money, match my skills. And I met some other folks that had similar skill sets. And yeah, we kind of banded together. I also had a couple friends from college that at the time had reached out to me and they said, hey, we're kind of running this e-commerce agency thing. There's this, you know, company called Shopify. I don't know if you've heard of it, but, you know, it's really booming and we could use your help. And I said, wow, that looks really interesting. I always loved the idea of e-commerce. And one thing led to another. I ended up joining them. And I got really embedded into the Shopify ecosystem. We were also doing work at the time for Magento, BigCommerce eventually came into the picture. But as time went on, I would say around 2017, a really big change, maybe it was 2016, a really big change hit the market. So for the engineers that are listening, you know, this was the advent of essentially jQuery going away. You have something called React. What this meant was, you could build websites as if they were applications themselves. And really what this meant is our merchants that were our clients were very interested in things they can do to speed up the website because they knew that the faster their website went, the higher their conversion rates would be. And that was a really important business metric for them. And so we started to experiment with some of this new technology on the front end. It worked really well, except for the fact that it was a nightmare, not on the front end, but the back end. We had to do an incredible amount of logic and build a significant amount of infrastructure for our clients just to keep these new things up and running. And at some point after like the fourth or fifth merchant of doing this, where we weren't profitable because we were spending so much money on the infrastructure, we realized, or, you know, hey, that's actually the bigger opportunity. What if we could actually build this infrastructure and sell it to other agencies so that they could build on top of it and you know, make these great experiences for their clients on the front end?
So then, how does one thing lead to the next, and then all of a sudden you are operating Nacelle? I mean, what happened there?
I think you learn really quick if you've ever done the consulting thing and also the startup thing that you can't do both at the same time. Actually, some people are able to do it, and kudos to them. That is very impressive because it's, I think both things take a lot of energy. I think it's very hard to be split brain about these things, right? So I was trying to straddle both for a while, and I got to the point where I said, you know what, enough's enough. Let's burn the ships behind us. Let's let the agency business go. I found homes for all of my clients. And I said, I'm just going to jump off this cliff. And I don't know what's on the other side, but I'm going to make the jump. And I went for it. And very quickly, you know, obviously one of the primary things is, well, there's a lot of technology to build here. You know, if I'm not really getting a paycheck from my agency anymore, what are the things I can do? You know, it's not going to be profitable anytime soon because we have to build a lot of things to make this right. And so, you know, raising capital became a really natural next step. So I was able to kind of burn the ships behind us and focus 100% on this new company and this new idea we had. And I was fortunate enough to have some connections in the industry and meet some, you know, across my travels there, I was able to meet some really prominent people. Today, some of your viewers might know them. Andrew Bilecki is the founder and CEO of Klaviyo. He was one of the first checks in. Brian Long was founder and CEO of Attentive. And he was another check-in. Steve Weiss was another one. He ran this company called Mute6, which was one of the biggest media buyers in the Shopify ecosystem, eventually got bought by Dentsu. And another one that was very supportive of me, but thought I was foolish for selling the agency, was actually Oisin O'Connor. And he's the founder and CEO of a company called Recharge that's doing very well. So
he's been on the show too. So,
has he really? He's a great guy.
Yeah. So I guess for the people that are listening to get the Nacelle, you know, the business model, how you guys make money, what does that look like?
Yeah, so we are a SaaS company, and historically we've charged a SaaS subscription fee. However, the vision was always to get into payments. We thought the big innovation we saw that Shopify made was that they charged a very, very low SaaS fee when a lot of their competitors were charging really high SaaS fees. And we realized that what Shopify was doing was actually brilliant. They were worked out a deal with Stripe, and they were able to negotiate using their economies of scale to get the price of Stripe low for Shopify. And then they were able to charge their merchants the full rate transaction fee and make money on the spread. And we realized, oh my gosh, every merchant is going to have to pay a transaction fee. To make money on the transaction fee means you don't then have to charge an excess amount to actually use the software. That was the innovation of Shopify, and we were always intrigued by that idea. So we always wanted to get into transactions. So we recently released a checkout that let us do that. That was always the vision, but initially that was a lot to build a checkout. And so we had to charge a sort of annual subscription to the service.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's go back to the way that you guys went about raising money, because it was quite the strategy. So obviously you were mentioning some of those incredible angel investors. So walk us through that strategy, because I know that you haven't really shared this, and there's going to be a first time that I'm sure is going to really help, you know, a lot of the founders out there, because so far you guys have been very successful on raising money, $75 million raised. But walk us through, how has it been, the whole strategy and the whole experience of raising the money from the beginning all the way up until now?
So I think the first thing that your listeners, if they don't already know, if you're going to decide to do a business that has a really big addressable market and you're going to go for it, you're going to build something that's 10x better than what's already out there. You know, these things don't just happen with a few hundred thousand dollars, usually. Sometimes, but usually that's not the case. The way the VC model works is a really important thing to keep in mind when you go for this style of business. And so, you know, without getting into too much detail, and I think probably most of your followers will understand this, but VCs make money only when they hit a home run. So you can't hit a single or double. Those are okay. But what they're after is the one company in their portfolio that's going to go public and knock it out of the park and return the whole value of the fund. That is really what they're searching for. So a single or a double, these sort of base hit plays, they're not as important. So if you're going after a really big idea, you want to use that to your advantage. The other thing that's really important in the world of raising from institutional is you need momentum. And so the idea of getting momentum becomes almost this critical thing that you need to have. But how do you have momentum when you don't have any? It's a bit of like this chicken and the egg problem. And I think this is not talked about nearly enough in the world. I hope this maybe could spark a conversation amongst your listeners. Often as an entrepreneur, you're in a very unique position, right? There aren't there aren't that many entrepreneurs in the world. I'm sure when you're reading TechCrunch and everything, it seems like there's, you know, millions of them. But the truth is there aren't that many entrepreneurs in the world. And so if you are an entrepreneur, one of the best things you can do beyond just fundraising is network and reach out to other entrepreneurs. Literally send them a cold message, right? I mean, like if you want to reach out to me, you could, you know, check out my LinkedIn and send me a message. I will respond. I will do my best to respond. It's not just important for fundraising. It's also important to have the right mentality. And you're not going to read about that in a book. You're not going to, you know, go to graduate school and learn about that. You're really only going to learn about that from the experiences that other entrepreneurs had. And so connect and relate with some of those folks really early on, maybe even before you start. And I think that's one of the best things you can do. What happened in my world is I realized that there's this thing called QSBS in the United States. It's essentially a tax break. And so if you are a later stage CEO and you raise something like, you know, a Series C, Series D, or, you know, something close, this doesn't always happen. But at the time in the market, there was a lot of what's called secondary transactions going on. And this is the idea where an entrepreneur, after, you know, 5-7 years of slugging it out, they'll say, hey, look, I want to take a little bit off the table. And, you know, they'll find some investors that actually buy their common shares. In exchange for that, they get peace of mind, a little bit of peace of mind. But also, if they did it right, they're able to execute something called QSBS, which means if they take those dollars and they reinvest it in another company that has QSBS, like another startup, they don't actually have to pay the tax on that sale. It's actually brilliant. It's actually this thing that just really sparks and encourages innovation and something that I really believe in. And so what I realized is, okay, well, of my friends who are entrepreneurs, like who's doing big rounds? And who's doing later stage rounds? And can I ask them if they're interested in investing in a cell in a pre-seed round, in an angel round? And my surprise response is I got a lot of yeses. And a big piece that fueled this were secondary transactions that were coming in. So I really think for your listeners, if they're able to build a network with entrepreneurs, not just early stage, but also the later stage folks, it's a really, really, really great move. Because these folks are often willing to say, yeah, look, I took a little off the table, you know, I can give you a little check. When you get big names, you know, early in your round, in your pre-seed round, that naturally sparks momentum with other institutional VCs. They will hear about it. They will hear about it. And you'll start to get them knocking on the door as opposed to you knocking on their door.
And then what was the experience too of shifting from individuals to institutionals? You know, what other strategies, you know, did you learn about rallying, you know, institutionals?
When we started to get a little transaction, I asked my angels, hey, who are the institutions that you would do business with again? That was really important to me. I didn't want, I wanted it to be value add, like real value add, not just like BS, right? Like I wanted this to be, hey, if you know, if we're trying to close a large customer and the customer's unsure of our financial situation, will you pick up the phone and talk to them and be like, no, these people are good. You're in good hands. That was the kind of value add I was looking for. And what happens if your angel friends are clever, which I'm sure they are, they'll start to make the introduction because it also, they're proud of it. Hey, look, I put this small amount of money into this company. They're doing these really great things. Let me tell you about it. That is like they're doing the pitch for you before you even start on the first slide. It creates this momentum and this energy and this, I'll use the word buzz, even though I don't really like this word. People were talking about Nacelle in the venture community when we were doing our seed and our Series A round before I had to really knock on any doors. If you can get yourself into a situation like that by leveraging, you know, your angel network, I think it's a really, really great strategic move.
And now in terms of the vision too, because vision is a really big one for investors, no? So if you were to go to sleep tonight, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Nacelle is fully realized, what does that world look like?
E-commerce is one of those funny tech industries where there's not a winner take all. So I think most folks are familiar with Shopify, but Shopify itself only has like 10% market share in SMB in total. So even in enterprise, it's much smaller than that. you would think a name that's almost like a household name at this point, you know, like a Google, they have something like, what, 70% market share, 80% market share. They probably try to keep that lower, not higher. But it is not a winner-take-all industry. And there's really an argument to be said that there's no strong network effects that happen in e-commerce. And so part of my pitch is, look, we're carving out this special niche. We're looking for merchants that are either venture-backed and want the absolute best in terms of customer shopping experience, or large retailers that are getting into digital. They're not going to go to the traditional incumbents because it wasn't made for them. And so I kind of just painted this sort of gray space in the market. It's obviously a very, very large market. And I wasn't shy about the vision too. I thought I'd get laughed out of more rooms, but I didn't. In fact, and this is actually a first to the world, I actually applied to Y Combinator and I had an interview, and they actually didn't move forward with us. And their reason is that they said, well, we don't like your go-to-market because you're piggybacking on Shopify merchants, and we don't think Shopify is going to exist in 5 years. So go figure. I think that's my other piece of advice. Like, don't be discouraged if even prominent angels or institutional firms say no. First of all, they could say no for the wrong reason. There's a lot of politics at these firms. You don't know where the fund is at. People have different ideas. So yeah, I think pitching the vision is really, really important. If you go back to this idea that a VC wants that home run, you have a big vision. If you're listening to this podcast, like, you probably have this big vision. Don't undermine it in any way. Go for it. Don't be bold. Like, VCs know if you're not bold in front of them, it's going to be very hard for you to be bold leading a company and pushing a whole company forward, right? So go for it. Pitch them on the big idea. Don't hold back. Don't do this thing where, oh, we're going to do one thing and then this other thing. Silly. Just go for it. And I think you'll actually be surprised at how well the institutional financing world and venture capital responds to that.
Now, let's talk about here about the, because we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back to the moment where you were coming out of Babson, you know, thinking that it was time to conquer the world as an entrepreneur. And let's say you were able then to have a chat with that younger Brian, and you were able to give that younger Brian one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah. There's one thing that pops to mind right away. There, in my opinion, there's a misconception around differentiators and competitors. And this is all related to kind of this very common business concept of barriers to entry. So I think a lot of entrepreneurs have a good idea and then get discouraged because, oh, well, someone else is already doing that in the marketplace, or, oh, well, that's too easy to copy. Okay, so to kind of paint this picture, let's take the extreme opposite. Let's take SpaceX, like Elon Musk. Okay, so obviously he has this massive barrier to entry. He's like the only one that could land rockets, right? Like this is a huge technical feat. I'm sure there's a ton of patents around it. I'm sure there's like a lot of know-how. I mean, that's a serious barrier to entry for a startup, right? And then here comes Blue Origin, and they could land rockets too, okay? Outside of brands, barriers to entry, it's very hard. Even if you have a patent, there is most likely other ways to do that thing that your patent doesn't cover. So I would go back to myself and shake myself silly a little bit and be like, don't try to dream up this grand master plan where you have all these ideas and these great barriers to entry. That's really a fool's task. Instead, think about this idea of how technology works. It moves really fast, and it's much more important to find something that's product market fit and then stay 6 months ahead of what everyone else is doing by constantly innovating and improving the product. If you're able to do that, that is the best barrier to entry you will ever get in the startup world. Stay 6 months ahead of competition and keep innovating, and use your venture capital dollars to continuously push the product and innovate. In fact, I wouldn't even have to go back to when I started. I could go back 2-3 years ago to Nacelle, where, you know, I felt like we were in a great position, and I took my eye off the ball a little bit on product engineering, And, you know, I think we lost some of the initial edge that we have. Now, luckily, we've got it back and it feels really good. But don't lose sight of this idea that technology moves really fast and your competitors are going to, if you have a good idea, they will copy you. That's not a bad thing. Okay. It's okay. That's great. I'd love to be the blueprint for, you know, my competitor's product roadmap, right? But the key, you have to continuously invest and continuously be innovative and continuously talk to customers, continuously keep product market fit and stay 6 months ahead. That is a much better strategy than trying to create this grand master plan with patents and all these barriers to entry that really could just fall apart tomorrow anyway.
So talking about lessons learned too, tell us about balancing, you know, work and life, because I know that's important for you. And then also the way that people are missing out on really being energized and finding their energy.
I think that's what it's all about, right? To me, life is, especially this kind of life. Look, if you are not extremely passionate about the problem you decide to pick, it's highly unlikely you're going to make it. You have to be so, so drawn to this. And it's almost like you have to be willing to try this maybe like 3, 4, 5 times over and over again, because it might not work the first time and that's okay. So number one, like if you are passionate about an idea, then your life becomes all about how do I get that energy to continuously fuel that passion, right? So literally think of it as like gasoline going into your tank. And that tank can get filled in many different ways. Jeff Bezos presented this idea of work-life harmony, which is very different than work-life balance. So one, I think, potential mistake that folks might make is they say, look, you know, 40 hours of work, sure, that's like a normal work week. You know, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm working really hard, so I'm going to do 50 hours of work, 55 hours of work, whatever, pick your number. I fundamentally disagree with that. Why? Because maybe your brother-in-law calls you and he's having a really hard time with whatever situation he's in. And you know what? That week, you're going to have to talk to your brother-in-law and spend some time with him and just be a good friend, a good family member, right? When you end that, you're going to feel really good and hopefully you help them out a little bit in any ways you can, even if it just means picking up the phone and talking to them and listening to them. That is going to fuel you and energize you for the really hard work that you have to do that's coming up. I think that's really important. And the same is true on the other side. You know, imagine calling a friend because you're concerned about whatever it is that you're concerned about in life, but they're under pressure from a performance review that didn't go so well. And they're afraid of, you know, maybe getting fired, you know, in the next couple of weeks. It's going to be really hard to have a high quality conversation with that person at that time, right? So these things are interrelated, and that's why this idea of harmony and sort of understanding the natural ebb and flow of work life and non-work life and not trying to like set boundaries and boxes around them becomes really, really important, not just for your startup culture and the rest of your team, but also for you as the entrepreneur starting a business. Like, you are going to have to go through and take some hits and take some punches. And if you don't have that work-life harmony worked out, I just think it's going to be 10 times harder.
Now, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, Brian, what is the best way for them to do so?
I'm an avid LinkedIn. I'm like kind of obsessed with LinkedIn right now. The other social media stuff is not really my cup of tea. I find it really inspiring. I love that it's a whole network built on people who are passionate about their work life. And if you'd like to reach out to me, I will be as responsive as I possibly can on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us today.
Likewise, Alejandro. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.